Saturday, December 13th, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM, LP, in Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, your host for Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear a conversation with Luella Bryant. Luella Bryant's short stories have won the Ralph Nading Hill Award, the Kingdom Award, and Writers in the Park, Raymond Carver, and Writer's Digest Awards for short fiction. Her first book, The Black Bonnet, which concerns the Underground Railroad in Vermont, was a finalist for the Vermont Book Award. Her second book, Father by Blood, about John Brown's raid on Harper's Ferry, won the Silver Bay Children's Literature Award. She has taught writing at the University of Vermont and Castleton State College and serves on the faculty of the Spalding University MFA in Writing Program in Louisville, Kentucky. Her latest book, While in Darkness, There is Light, was the book that we discussed when I spoke to Luella in November. I began by asking her how she came to be a writer.
I guess I've always wanted to write. My father wrote poetry and used to leave it around the house. Sometimes if he had to leave me a note, he'd leave a little poem instead of the note. Mm. I started writing in 1996 or 95, I believe. And a story came to me about the Underground Railroad in Vermont. So I wrote a little book called The Black Bonnet. Mm. And it just flowed out of me. So I thought writing is pretty easy because these stories just happen. The second book was not so easy. Then I began to realize that writing is actually pretty hard. You have to commit yourself to it.
Now, was The Black Bonnet a work of fiction?
It's a work of fiction for young adults.
Okay.
And it's set in Burlington about two slave sisters who are escaping on the Underground Railroad. Mm. And they stop in Burlington on their way to Canada. So that was published in 1997 by New England Press.
Okay. Did you go to the Rokeby Museum and do research there and everything? Or?
I did a lot of research. The story came to me while I was at the Converse home in Burlington, which supposedly was a safe house on the Underground Railroad.
Oh, I didn't know that. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Because the Rokeby Museum, I think, is an Underground Railroad safe house as well. It's been turned into a museum to the whole thing.
It is, yes.
Yeah. I wonder, there must have been a lot of stops up here then, because that's maybe the third or fourth I've heard of.
I think people would like to believe that their old houses were safe houses on the Underground Railroad. After the book came out, I got a lot of phone calls from people saying, would you come look at this little hidey hole in my house and see if you think it was a stop on the Underground Railroad?
Did you say yes?
It was hard to do that. I did a tour of Brandon of safe houses. Mm. I learned a lot from doing it. Mm. I spent some time at UVM too, and WCAX did a little article on the book and some of the controversy surrounding the Underground Railroad.
Mm-hmm.
It was very educational. And then the next book was about John Brown's raid on Harper's Ferry, mm-hmm. because it's set a year after The Black Bonnet, and I figured, since I'd done all that research, I might as well use it for another book.
Sure, plus you had an audience at that point.
Plus I had an audience, yeah. Right.
How many books have you written?
I've written two historical fictions for young adults and then a picture book about adaptive skiing. My sister-in-law runs an adaptive ski program at Waterville Valley. So okay. I wrote a picture book about a boy who learns to ski with the help of a boy who skis with a special chair in an adaptive ski program.
Okay.
And that little book has done really well among special audiences,
mm-hmm.
and I'm very proud of that one.
Mm. So how did you come to write While in Darkness, There is Light?
Well, Howard Dean was running for president, and it was 2003, and there were news reports that he was going to Hawaii to receive his brother Charlie's remains. Charlie had been killed in Laos in 1974. And my husband, Harry Reynolds, and I were sitting on the front porch, and he started talking about Charlie Dean and his friendship with Charlie, and how he and Charlie had lived on this commune in Australia for a while. And he started talking about the commune, and then he said Charlie had really wanted to see Southeast Asia, invited Harry to go with him, and Harry said, "I've run out of money, I have to go back to the States." And Charlie said, "Well, I'm going." And he was taken prisoner by the communist Pathet Lao and held in a prison camp for 3 months and then executed. And I said, "This sounds like it ought to be a book. Do you have any other information I can look at?" So he disappeared and he came back with a big shoebox, and in the shoebox were letters he had written to his mom, and she had kept all the letters, mailed from Australia. There were letters from Charlie that were mailed from Southeast Asia. Yeah. One was mailed the day before he left for Laos. And there were photographs from the farm. And there was a leather-bound journal in which he had documented events that took place on the farm, all of which involved Charlie. And I said, "May I use this to, you know, take some notes?" And he said, "Sure." So I started transcribing the notes, and then I thought, you know, I better get in touch with Howard before I start in on this project, because if someone were writing a book about my brother's death, I'd want to know about it. So I called Democracy for America, which was an organization in Burlington that Howard started. It still exists in Burlington, and left a message. And when Howard was in town for the weekend, he called me and he said, "Why don't you and Harry come in and we'll talk about it."
Had you met him before?
I had met him before, sort of peripherally. Mm-hmm. But he knew Harry because they went to high school together. Mm-hmm. So we went in and he was glad to see Harry. And we sat down and talked. And he talked about going to Laos to look for Charlie's remains. And the experience of finding him, and it was very moving. I was really moved, especially when he talked about standing in the spot where Charlie was shot, and sifting through dirt looking for a tooth or a bone fragment that belonged to his brother. So I asked him if I could write a book about Charlie's time in Australia leading up to his death, and he said, "How can I help?" And I said, "You can write the foreword talking about what you just told me." And he said, "I'll do it." And I think the reason he agreed to it was because he and Charlie and Harry had gone to a boarding school in Newport, Rhode Island together. And they'd known each other since they were 14 years old. And I think he trusted me because I was married to Harry. And in boarding school, classmates become sort of like an extended family. Mm-hmm. So I felt very honored that he'd share that story with me. And he actually was very helpful throughout the writing of the book in putting me in touch with CIA records and people who were helpful for me to interview. Mm-hmm. And other documents. So he sort of held my hand through the whole thing, and I really owe him a debt. Mm-hmm. In the writing of the book.
What about Charlie Dean's story most interested you, do you think?
That's an interesting question. As the mother of sons, young adult sons, I was really moved by his loss at such a young age. He was 24 when he was killed. He just barely turned 24. And I felt that loss as a mother. And also, because he had asked Harry to go with him, just if Harry had said yes instead of no, he would have been shot with Charlie, because Charlie had, he met a young Australian in Darwin, Neil Sharman, and Neil went with Charlie and was taken prisoner with Charlie and was executed with Charlie. And it could very well have been Harry or any of the other people from the farm. Mm. And I was sort of struck by how young men especially, but some young women too, just walk into the face of peril, and not blindly. And Charlie was very aware that there was a war going on in Southeast Asia, and Neil had been a journalist, so he certainly was aware of what was going on. And yet they continued on this journey, even though they saw Pathet Lao forces with rifles, they heard guns going off, and yet they continued into Laos. Hmm. And I wanted to sort of find the answer to the question, why? Why did they just keep marching into what they knew was dangerous territory? Mm-hmm. So that question led me through the book. Mm-hmm. I was also intrigued by this culture of rich young men who abandon their upbringing. They abandon their Republican fathers and their the Wall Street background they grew up with, and they went into the wilderness of Australia and lived, you know, a very primitive lifestyle. Mm-hmm. So I was curious about why they did that as well. I entered the book with a lot of questions that I wanted to have answers to, and I got answers to some of them. There's still questions that are open, and I think that's a good thing. I think people will ask those questions as they read the book, I hope.
Did you find out anything that nobody had known before as you were researching?
Well, nobody really knew what Charlie had done on the farm in Australia except the people who were on the farm. And I think that's one of the things I kept in mind as I was writing the book. Charlie was not a big letter writer. Harry was a letter writer. I think Charlie made a few phone calls home during the year he spent on the farm, but he didn't write many letters. And so his brothers, Howard and Bill and Jim, didn't really know what was going on the farm during that time. Mm. And so I tried to answer those questions for them. And another question I answered just in terms of why young men do these things is I thought of Maslow's hierarchy of basic needs, and four of those needs are met by your parents. You know, the need for shelter, the need for nurture, the need for safety, and the need for love and acceptance. But the fifth need is self-actualization. And since the beginning of humankind, young men have been going out to prove their manhood, mm-hmm. and to find what they're meant to do in life. And I think that's what they were doing. You know, they very easily could have taken positions in their father's companies and settled down into an establishment lifestyle. But they wanted to have their own lives. They wanted to find out who they were. You know, Thoreau did that when he went to Walden Pond, and the ancient Greeks did that when they went out and slayed minotaurs and other monsters. And I think they needed to do that in order to prove to themselves that they were worthy to be on this planet. I think that's what they were trying to do.
Hmm. He was very disillusioned by George McGovern's loss, I remember from the book. Do you think that kind of impulsive, was it an impulsive decision? Was it a common thing for young men to do at that time period with all the political upheaval of the time to travel away?
You sort of have to see this time period in its place in history. In 1963, John F. Kennedy was assassinated. Less than 5 years later, in April 1968, Martin Luther King was assassinated. Less than 2 months later, in June, Bobby Kennedy was assassinated. Less than 2 years later, 4 students were killed on the campus of Kent State University. Every day, we watched Walter Cronkite, and he showed footage of caskets being unloaded off military airplanes, young men's bodies being brought back from Vietnam. We were very aware of our own mortality. We were very aware that with a flip of the coin, your life could be over. And I think young men felt like they needed to do something about that. They needed to make a statement about it. For Charlie and the other young men at St. George's School, they were impressed with the responsibility to serve. And this was an idea that came from their fathers who had served in the military during World War II.
Mm-hmm.
It also came from St. George's. They were told to serve their communities, to serve their country, and to serve their God. And that was very important. And they took that responsibility very seriously. And I think especially for Charlie, he was looking for a way to serve. He was senior prefect at St. George's School. He was involved in student government at UNC Chapel Hill. And I know he went to Southeast Asia to find a way to be of service, to be of help. I think he felt an empathy for the soldiers who'd gone to Southeast Asia to fight. And when he got there, he wrote letters back begging the farmers to come to Southeast Asia and help make the lives of these people better. The refugees were, their lives were, you know, they didn't have enough to eat. They were frightened that any moment they might be taken captive. They were forced into service of the Pathet Lao. And Charlie thought, maybe I should stay here and see if I can help these people. So the desire to serve was very strong in him. I like to think, I know that Charlie was very spiritual. When he was at St. George's, he was head of the Acolytes Guild. He'd gone to church all his life. He'd studied Buddhism. So I think spiritual service was very important to him. And I would like to believe in my heart that when he was put in that prison camp in Southeast Asia, that he found a way to serve. And it makes me emotional just thinking about it. But from reading about the prison camps in Laos, I know that there were prisoners who'd been there for years. And I know that they were disheartened. And I think that Charlie might have been the ray of light that they were looking for.
Hmm.
Because he had that ability with people. He had the ability to give people hope.
Mm-hmm.
He had the ability to bring peace, a sense of peace to people. And I really believe that he did that when he went to Southeast Asia.
Mm-hmm. What were the phases of your research for this book?
This is my first book of nonfiction, and I found it very difficult to write a story that is not just boring historical facts.
Mm-hmm.
So I think as a creative nonfiction writer, I had to find the story within the history. And I had a little bit of experience doing that, writing historical fiction with my first two books.
Mm-hmm.
So I sort of drew on that. And as you'll see when you read the book, the first chapter is a fictionalized story of Charlie's capture. And the reason that came about is because the book began in an early draft with chapters set at St. George's School, and I gave the manuscript to a writer friend to read, and I said, what do you think? And he said, it doesn't grab me. Because it was just, you know, basically facts about St. George's and how St. George's came to be and what it was like going to school at St. George's. And I said, well, how can I grab you? And he said, what's the most compelling scene in the book? And I knew immediately what it was. It was the scene of Charlie's capture, and I hadn't written it because I didn't know how to write it. But I said, that's the most compelling scene. And he said, that's your first chapter, without hesitation. So I went back to Howard, and I said, what do we know about his capture? And he gave me some links to some CIA sites and some other sites that had documentation about exactly where Charlie was when he was captured. The fact that the camera he was carrying had something to do with the reason he was captured. The fact that he was on a ferry boat on the Mekong River. And there was a lot of factual information. So I found some websites that talked about tourism on the Mekong, riding the ferry boats, what that was like. And I tried to put myself in that position with what I knew about Charlie. And I created that scene and tried to make it as true to life as I could. But of course, it had to be fictionalized. So I added some Laotian expressions. I added some Laotian characters, again, from my research. But whether that exact mother was in that exact ferry boat on that precise day with her child or not, I'm not certain.
Mm-hmm.
She is in my book, but that's what makes it creative nonfiction.
Mm-hmm.
I also talked with George Colt, who wrote a blurb for the book, and he read a manuscript that I thought was just about finished, and he called me up and said, do you mind if I give you a few suggestions? And I said, George Colt, National Book Award finalist, giving me suggestions? No, I don't mind at all. And he said, the eye sort of glazes over when I read some of these historical details, and you need to find a way to bring them to life. And so I revisioned some of that history through the eyes of the characters. So the history, writing the history, was pretty easy for me.
Mm-hmm.
Transforming it into story was much more challenging. And I was doing that up, you know, right through the galley. I made 40 changes in the galley and wanted to rewrite the whole book from the galley. But had to restrain myself. I have to say, though, you know, probably the book has gone through 30 or 40 revisions, and I'm pretty happy with it the way it is.
Mm-hmm.
When I read The Black Bonnet, I find that I edit the book, but I haven't really done much editing at all with this book. I'm pretty happy with it
mm-hmm.
as it is.
Have you traveled to Australia or Southeast Asia at all?
I have been to Australia. I've been to Rosebud Farm.
Oh, you did? Did you do that in conjunction with the research?
I did, yeah. I figured I really better go there and see what it's like. And I don't think it's changed a lot since...
So the farm's still going?
Actually, the farm just celebrated its 38th anniversary.
Wow.
It's still run by one of the young men who established the farm in 1970. He was 19 years old at the time, and he's now 58. It is the largest producer of exotic palm trees in the world.
Wow.
And it's still called Rosebud Farm, and it's still run by Rich Trapnell.
That's wonderful. Did Harry go with you?
He did, yeah.
That must have been such an exciting experience.
It was exciting for him to go back there. I think it was also very difficult for him because he had just graduated from Harvard when he went. And he had known all his life was playing hockey, and he played for Harvard. So when he went to the farm as a 22-year-old, he was in the process of redefining himself, of finding himself, of trying to self-actualize, as Maslow would say. And it was a really difficult and painful time for him. he felt very vulnerable and very insecure. And I think some of those insecurities came back to him when he went back to the farm, you know, in his 50s. So it was not an easy trip for him.
Mm.
But I certainly felt what it was like to be there. The bunkhouse is now Rich's home, so that's changed. He's redone the kitchen. One of the things I found out about Rosebud Farm is that it was infested with pythons, that pythons are non-poisonous, and they used to invite pythons in to eat the rats. And there's one of the things I learned was that pythons in the cold weather come into the buildings and climb up into the rafters to warm up. So I asked Rich jokingly if there were any pythons in the house, and he checked the rafters and said, "Sometimes, but I don't see any up there now." So I was a little nervous spending a couple of nights at Rosebud Farm in case pythons decided to crawl under the covers to warm up with me, but I didn't see any pythons while I was there. I did see some pretty big spiders,
yeah.
But they looked fairly benign.
Where exactly is Rosebud Farm in comparison to Sydney, Perth, Melbourne?
It's north of Cairns, which is
okay.
In what they call far north Queensland.
Mm-hmm.
So if you go to Cairns, we flew into Sydney, and then we flew to Cairns. And then you rent a car, and Caranda, which is where the farm is about a half an hour up in the Tablelands from Cairns.
Okay.
And it's in the mountains away from the ocean. Cairns is kind of a resort area for Australians. They come up from Sydney and Melbourne, sort of like Florida. Australia is like the United States upside down and south of the equator in the southern hemisphere. So far north Queensland is really kind of an exotic tropical place to go.
Mm-hmm.
When you get cold. And their winter is our summer. So when we went there in July, it was actually their winter, which is the best time to go because it's the dry season. The wet season is no fun because it rains all the time.
Now, you've mentioned Howard a number of times. How involved was his family in your research?
I gave early drafts of the manuscript to his brothers, Jim and Bill, to read. And they are much younger than Howard. Charlie was 17 months younger than Howard, so it was sort of like Howard and Charlie, and then there was a gap in time, and Jim and Bill came later. They were helpful in giving me a little bit of information about Charlie's character, in that he was very spiritual. They knew that. And he also spent his summers from the time he was in high school working at a camp for underprivileged boys on Long Island. But other than that, they didn't have a lot of information for me
mm-hmm.
about Charlie. They went to St. George's School also, but long after Charlie had graduated.
Mm-hmm.
But I was very glad to get their approval of the project. That meant a lot to me.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't heard from them since the book has come out, and I suppose that's a good thing.
No news is good news. did writing this book change or intensify your opinions of the Vietnam era in American history at all?
I think writing the book informed me about that era. I lived through it too, so in a way it validated a lot of the feelings I had about that time. I was at George Washington University in Washington, D.C. during a lot of the demonstrations, so I was in the thick of it.
Mm.
I didn't have the option of leaving the country because I didn't have the financial resources to do that. So it was very difficult for me because I worked my way through college working for a big law firm in Washington, D.C. So I'd wear my jeans and sweatshirt to class in the mornings occasionally fighting my way through tear gas and avoiding billy clubs and trying not to get arrested. But seeing that all around me, and then I'd go to my apartment and change into a dress and stockings and heels and go to my job at the law firm in the afternoons. So I sort of led a double life.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very difficult for me to try to figure where I fit in. So I think I've always been sort of an observer, and that really has helped me have an emotional distance from the events, both as they were happening and as I was able to relive them through the book.
Mm-hmm.
I also am a woman, which gave me a different perspective on it because I didn't have a draft lottery number. I knew a lot of people who did. So I had a lot of empathy, but not a direct involvement with the events of that time. But I certainly was aware of the potential for violence, having been to a lot of those demonstrations. I don't think there's anything as frightening as being involved in a mob. And a lot of those demonstrations were, you realized that if somebody screamed or if somebody started running, there could be a stampede and people could get, you know, really injured or someone could be killed. I remember at one demonstration, somebody overturned an ice cream truck. And I thought, you know, why? And it's just because somebody got the idea and started doing it and somebody thought it was a good idea and they pitched in and eventually the truck was overturned, and then you sort of stand back and say, why did we do that?
Mm-hmm.
And I think there was a lot of that going on. It was just jumping in the river, and the current was so swift, there was no way to swim against it, and so we swam with it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it was good that I was able to get away from the campus in the afternoons and sort of get my head straight and then go back into it the next day.
Mm-hmm. Maybe this would be a good time for you to read a part of the book.
I'll read from a section in chapter 3 that gives you a sense of the time in which these boys were living. The scene here is set at Harvard University, where Harry Reynolds and Rich Trapnell are students.
This is Luella Bryant reading from While in Darkness, There is Light, published by Black Lawrence Press.
On autumn afternoons, the voices of Crosby, Stills and Nash, James Taylor and Bob Dylan wafted from open dormitory windows and across Harvard Yard on wisps of marijuana smoke. The times, they are a-changin', Dylan sang. Hair grew shaggy and whiskers appeared soft and fuzzy on nearly every chin. Button-down collars and three-piece suits, attended classes with black turtlenecks and jeans. Walking to meals, students of kindred attitudes and styles stuck together like schools of fish, not game to venture outside their circles. Rich remembers the energy in Harvard Yard as extraordinary. So many minds collected in one place, it was truly electric, frightening, and totally exhilarating. The world seemed to turn faster in those days. The young men had watched on TV as Apollo 11 landed on the moon and had been hypnotized when Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin took the first steps on moon dust. As they were packing for college, 500,000 people converged on Bethel, New York, for the Woodstock Music Festival. Harry's favorite TV program was The Dick Van Dyke Show, and he had a boyish crush on Mary Tyler Moore. Although they didn't have much time for television, they occasionally caught episodes of Gunsmoke, Laugh-In, and The Red Skelton Show. If they were even vaguely aware of the 18 Americans who within the previous 4 years had committed suicide in opposition to the war in Vietnam, 8 by setting themselves afire, the deaths seemed remote and unconnected to their own lives.
I remember reading that in... You know, it seems like such a long time ago
A lot of times the question comes up when I read that section, why aren't there protests today against the Iraq war? And I usually turn the question back to the audience and say, well, what do you think? Because I certainly don't have the answer. And some people say it's because of the draft lottery. But actually there was a draft before the lottery. There was a draft during World War II as well. So I'm not sure it was the draft. I think it was because the Vietnam War was very personal. We saw the deaths. And students were killed at Kent State. The potential for violence on our own campuses was much greater, I think, than it is today. And I think young people today are also insulated by technology.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if they're listening. I've heard from a lot of young people, including my own son, when I try to talk to him about the war, he'll say, I really don't want to hear about it. And I don't know if it's because they don't feel like it's their war or they don't feel somehow involved the way we did when we were their age. I'm not sure.
That footage of Vietnam on the television was sort of the first war footage that had been brought to us. And there's been so much more since then that it could be that they're a little desensitized to those images.
I think that's definitely a lot of it.
I'm not sure.
I hope that's one of the questions that people will ask when they read the book.
Do you mind if I just read one little bit of it?
Sure.
I read this and I was really taken by it. Rosebud Farm had a Neverland quality about it. Kim was Peter Pan, leader of the Lost Boys. Society was Captain Hook, the antithesis of youthful dreams, the adult world whose innocent idealism had been amputated and who was left with bitterness and lust for revenge against threatening cultures. The antagonists took the form of Kurunda cops, customs agents, and parents beckoning their boys home to traditional jobs and traditional paths toward their futures. But the Lost Boys were loath to leave. The mysteries of Australia held the Rosebud Company transfixed. I really liked that analogy to Never Never Land, but it also made me think about why Charlie left. Can you talk a little bit about why Charlie left Rosebud Farm?
Well, first of all, Charlie had a dream, and one of the reasons this book touches me so much is because his dream was very similar to Harry's dream. They both wanted to own a piece of land and you know, sort of have their little kingdom. Harry goes out on the front porch and sits and smokes a cigar and looks at his property. Every day he does that. And I think that he must think about Charlie, because I know Charlie wanted to do that as well. He knew that Rosebud Farm was not his operation. It was Kim Haskell's and Rich Trapnell's, and he knew that if he were going to have his own domain, it would be someplace else. And he was looking for that someplace else.
Mm-hmm.
So that was one reason he left. Another reason he left was very practical, and that is that there are two seasons in Australia, the wet season and the dry season. And the dry season is when all the farming gets done. That's, you know, when the weather's good and you get occasional rains and you get a lot of sunshine and the crops thrive. And then there's the wet season, which is their summer, and it rains every day and it rains hard. And the fields flood and nothing grows. And so that's when the farmers take vacation. And Harry left and went to Melbourne and got a job selling freezer chests door to door. Kim left and went to Tasmania on holiday. Rich stayed with the farm, and Charlie was trying to figure out his next move. One of the women on the farm, an Australian, had gotten pregnant by one of the Australian boys. And she gave birth and brought the baby to the farm, which sort of changed the dynamics. You know, there was baby paraphernalia all over the area, and so Charlie figured it was time for him to go. his idea was that he would go to Southeast Asia and see Cambodia and Thailand and Laos. I don't know if he'd planned to go to Vietnam or not. And then he was a little ambivalent about whether he was going to go on to India, perhaps with the idea to join the Peace Corps. But he wrote letters home saying that he was going to be, he wrote letters to the farmers saying he was going to be back on Park Avenue by Christmas. So I think he was planning to go back to New York, be with his family for Christmas, and then maybe go to India or Nepal and join the Peace Corps. But that idea of owning land was still with him. And that's one of the tragedies of the book, is that although Harry was able to realize his dream, Charlie never was.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very sad.
How do you keep from losing yourself in writing a story like this, which you know from the outset is a tragic story?
I don't keep from losing myself. When I read from the book, I never read the ending. I keep hoping that maybe it will end differently if I don't read it. As I said, I did 30 or 40 revisions, and every time I read the ending, I would cry, and I'd be depressed for days. I think a writer has to lose herself in her story. I've heard if a story is easy to write, it's probably not very good. And there were parts of this story that were agony to write. And I hope that means they're good. But yes, I think losing yourself is actually a good thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It makes me a very boring person to have dinner with because I don't want to talk about anything or think about anything except the book. And I've heard that about other writers as well. We make very boring dinner guests.
Well, not the first half hour. They say, really, you're a writer? What do you write?
Right. Never ask us that question.
Right. What's it about? Can you talk about the book's title a little bit? Did you come up with the title, or was that an idea that came from your editor?
I came up with a lot of titles for the book. The original title was Rose Buddies, and I still like that title, and I wish that were the title. When Harry left the farm, he left, I think it was January 2nd, just after they'd had this big New Year's celebration, 1974. He woke up early in the morning before anybody was up, and on the foot of his bed was a little bag of goodies with a little note from Charlie wishing him good journeys and telling him that they loved him.
Mm.
And it was signed Rose Buddies.
Mm.
And I thought, what a great name for the book. Because it really is about a friendship among four boys who are about the same age and came from similar backgrounds and had this remarkable experience in Australia. But the editors didn't like that title, so I had to search through the book for another title. And in Harry's journal, he wrote a lot of quotations. He's a reader, he's still a reader. And whenever he'd read something that struck him, he'd write it down. And "While in darkness there is light" is a quote from James Baldwin. And so I decided to use that because, for a number of reasons, I think adolescence or young adulthood, when you're searching for yourself, can be a very dark time, where you're trying to figure out who you really are. I remember that very well from, you know, my own young adulthood. And yet you always believe that somewhere at the end you're going to find the answer, you're going to find the light. So it was a time of darkness. But it was also a very dark time for Charlie when he was taken prisoner. And I like to think that he was the light. Again, the light that he brought to this prison camp. And I like to think also that he brought light into a lot of people's lives. Mm. And I think his spirituality also was a light for him in this very dark time. So the title, I think, has a lot of resonance.
Mm-hmm.
Australia is a very dark and light place as well. Because it's so near the equator, there's no dawn or dusk. You know, night falls like a shade being drawn very quickly, and morning comes like the shade springing up in the morning. So the title also represents, you know, the extremes. There are a lot of extremes in the book, you know, this extreme wealth set against this very primitive lifestyle that they experienced.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the title is fitting.
What are you working on now?
I am working on a number of things. Again, you know, going back to the beginning of our discussion, I was drawn to this subject because I'm the mother of sons. And I think a mother's greatest fear is that she'll lose a child, lose a son. So I've written a novel from a mother's point of view who has lost a son, and the son has been seduced by the romantic idealism of Islam, and he's gone off on this this journey, a spiritual journey. I'm very attracted to stories that have a spiritual quality to them. I'm interested in the idea of faith and where it comes from. So the mother is also on a very different sort of spiritual journey. She comes from a fundamentalist Christian background, and then she's got this son who's disappeared as he's sort of wandered off into Islam. So I'm still working on that. I have a few wrinkles I need to iron out. So I'm going to go back to that. Someone has also suggested that it might be good to write a series of vignettes about men and women, if I can find them, who had alternative experiences during the Vietnam War. It seems like every time I read this book, I'll get a man in his 50s who comes up to me and wants to tell me his story. And I've thought about collecting those. I actually have collected one story about a man who was at Kent State during the shootings and who was friends with one of the students who was killed.
Mm.
So toying with the idea, some of these stories are truly amazing.
My last question for you. What advice might you offer to writers who are stuck in their work or need help moving forward?
I teach creative writing in an MFA program at Spalding University, so I think about this a lot. I would say reading really good literature is the best way to get unstuck. If I'm away from my desk, I will Google piece of writing by Flaubert, and if I read a paragraph by Flaubert, the cork comes out of the bottle and I'm flowing again. If I'm home, I keep some really good books of poetry around me, and I read poetry. It's something about reading words that are organized in an artistic way that just gets me going.
Mm-hmm.
I love W.S. Merwin's poetry. I read Linda Hogan. Her nature poetry is really beautiful. Mary Oliver, Yusef Kumanyaka.
Mm-hmm.
Yusef Kumanyaka is a veteran of the Vietnam War and has a lot of poems about military service. So those were really helpful to me while I was writing While in Darkness. But poetry is very helpful to me. I also look at the dictionary and just pick up the thesaurus and breeze through that. Sometimes I read Bartlett's quotations. Just immersing myself in words. I also have a little word bag in my desk, and it's little words cut up on little pieces of paper. And sometimes I'll just sprinkle some words on my desk like fairy dust, mm-hmm. and see how I can fit them together, mm-hmm. and that gets me going as well. There's magic in writing.
Yeah.
There really is. Sometimes, like the passage you read, I don't remember writing that.
Hmm.
I don't know where that came from. Sometimes the words I feel come through me rather than from me, and that passage is an example of that. It's a magical thing, writing, if you believe in it.
Well, thank you very much for talking with me.
It was a pleasure.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Luella Bryant. Next week, tune in again to hear an interview with Linda Bland, author of Don't Stop at Green Lights and owner of Cahoots Writing Services. This might be a good time to say that the views expressed on Write the Book are solely those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of WOMMLP, its management board, or any of its affiliates. Write the Book is brought to you in part by Autism Support Daily, Vermont's first online support group and host of the annual Autism Walk each October at Battery Park. For more information, visit autismsupportdaily.com or call 985-8773. Today's Write the Book prompt is inspired by this holiday season. Love it or hate it, the season is upon us. Probably you have a great many catalogs piled up in your living room or on the back of a toilet somewhere waiting to be chucked in January. Why not use these to some advantage? Pour yourself a cup of tea or coffee, sit back in your coziest couch, and window shop for your characters. Pick out clothing, furniture, sunglasses. Pick out boots, necklaces, belts. Would your narrator wear new jeans or faded? Would his fleece have buttons or a zip? Would she be in heels or flats, boots or strappy sandals? Use your catalogs to fill out a scene whose details have been lacking. Sometimes the poses in magazines look wrong somehow. The snow looks synthetic, or the beach is off kilter. Why? What's missing? How might you write these settings more convincingly? You might look for the things your characters can't afford. What would substitute? Instead of that pricey lamp, how would she light her desk? A candle in a jelly jar? A flashlight? Look at your catalogs not with the eye of a buyer, but with the imagination of a writer. Make lists of ideas as you go, and then write without the catalog in hand for 20 minutes and see what develops. A copy of this prompt will be included in the description to this week's podcast on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com. Good luck with this exercise, and please listen next week for another. If you're interested in sharing Write the Book with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live every Saturday morning at 9 at www.theradiator.org. Archived episodes of Write the Book are also available, as I just said, on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. If you have comments about the show or events for next week's Bookworms calendar, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. And do tell your libraries and bookstores about the Bookworms calendar and encourage them to send us their activities and events. I'm going to ask that you enjoy some music now. Hike Bedrosian's going to be in this morning, but he'll be on the air at 10:30 today. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, in Burlington, Vermont.